Ooh.
Are we on? Ooh.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon indeed.
Thank you for coming.
So, how's ticket so far? Good. Sweet.
Yeah, that sounds
well. We'll ask the same question, right, in an hour. And we go, how ticket? You go, crap.
If you've got seats in the middle, you might want to just get a little cozy so that the latecomers can fit in on the edge of the aisles.
Just snuggle in. Just get close.
We didn't talk about that before.
Okay, so look, so we are 2 minutes in, so we're going to dive off. So good afternoon. I'm Andy Prowl. I'm the I do some stuff for Aura Information Security.
And my name's Kirk Jackson. I work at Xero and lead the security team there. So our job is really to try and keep Xero customers safe. Well, I guess Andy's job is to try and get into our systems.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So for those who don't know, we do security testing stuff. So for people like Xero, we try and hack and abuse their networks, which of course we never succeed to do, ever.
That's right.
Of course, because we're always good. So so we're here for the afternoon for an hour. A day in the life of an advanced persistent threatener. So we have two clear personas. Kirk will be the threatened person. I will be the threatener. So so what I do need to do is might as well start the session as I mean to go on a bit of a low-key note. So persona number one of an advanced persistent threatener. This is not Microsoft standard issue, but so persona number one. Can anyone tell what hacker persona number two? Script Kitty, thank you very much. Oh, good point. We have three giveaway prizes for people who actually get some of the gags. So we've only got three prizes, which pretty much will be everyone that gets the gags.
Oh, no, we've got five prizes.
Five prizes.
Plus a speaker from a previous talk left behind a T-shirt.
So we've got six prizes.
Which says open in the cloud, and that's not a security term. It's actually about Linux, PHP, Hadoop, etc.
Oh, and I think open in the cloud is a good security term.
And we've got a Twitter feed. Well, we don't actually have a Twitter feed because we're not organised, but I have a Twitter account, Kirk J. If you tweet things to it, feedback on the talk, stuff like that, with the TENZ, T-E-N-Z, hashtag at the same time, at the end we'll give away a Bluetooth speaker or two to those people. We'll try and keep at least one of them till the end. But if you pitch up, if you make noises during the talk, you might get other prizes.
Ooh.
Yeah. But so if you're not the kind of talking person, so you can do the Twitter thing.
So who put so who recognised me as a script kitty, Bevan? Would you like an 8 gig USB 3 Microsoft USB stick full of viruses? Excellent.
Hey, good throw.
Oh, no, thank you very much. Good catch. You're so script kitty number face. One. Okay. Persona number two that we'll be doing. Can you guess? Ni hao? Oh, thank you very much. There's a couple of those.
I thought we talked about that.
Oh, shush. Persona number two. Three, four. Persona number four. Oh, very good. Exactly. The US government. Or your trusted security
Since
guy.
You mentioned NSA, booby prize for you.
Woo-hoo! Sorry.
Ah, we always forget to put this slide up at the end of our talks. So this is the end slide. So we're posting our slides and notes if we get around to it, but definitely the slides on there. I wanted to pitch or pimp a day we're doing the day before KiwiCon in Wellington for app defenders. So if you're the security guy for a dev team, we'd love to see you there. Or girl, oops. And also there's our email addresses as well, so in case we forget to put them up.
And this is quite cool, some breaking news. So we thought hyper-topical. So just out the denial of service attack against ASP.NET. Groovy, have a read, have a look.
So that was in today's Patch Tuesday, and I put this slide together about an hour and a half ago, and since then Levi, who's on the ASP.NET security team, says that he doesn't think it does apply to ASP.NET. But basically the deal is that you should probably check that out when you get back to work.
And so should you, because you put it up there. So,
yeah. Okay. And then the other one is, I've got people looking at it right now, the other one is ViewState Mac. So if you guys are turning that off in your apps, as of today that stops working. And turning it off is a bit of a security anti-pattern. So they've been trying to disable that for about a year. Cool.
So let's dive in. So before we get into a day in the life of an advanced persistent threatener, what is an advanced persistent threat? Very simple. So let's start off with the levels of attack that we see for applications and networks around there in the world. What is tier one, Mr. Kirk?
So sticking anything on the internet, there's going to be a level of background activity that will come against your server. So there'll be scripts that are just running across the internet looking for open ports, etc. That's all just radiation on the internet.
That's really kidding.
And this study we've linked to here, under 40% of traffic on the internet is actually people. So a good chunk of it is search engines, but there's also a bunch of other hacking tools and other bad traffic that's going on the internet.
Whereas tier two, so this is the widespread attacks against the technology layer. So this is where the attackers and the advanced persistent threateners don't really care who you are, but they're just hacking the technology stack. So as we all know, so Heartbleed is an example, going after OpenSSL, whoever you were, wherever you were, didn't matter. It was the technology based.
Cool. And tier three are the industry targeted attacks. So the FBI have issued warnings over the last year of different industries that are being targeted. I think the Australian federal police or something, was investigating attacks against the banking sector in Australia. And this is where they're not necessarily targeting your company, but they're targeting your industry. So, you know, oil, energy sector, production, that kind of thing.
And look, what I love here with JP Morgan, right, just shows the different budgets around the world. So they last month announced to their shareholders that, well, they will be spending $250 million per year and deploying over 1,000 people, and that's one bank in the US. It's like, what the hell? So we're going to see if we can trip over and get some work with JP Morgan.
Good luck.
That's 500 times their current customer base.
For one customer. And then the last tier is really the ones that are attacking you, so either you as a person or you as a company. And these bottom two tiers are really where the advanced persistent threats come in. So these are attackers that are targeting your company or your industry sector. They're going after records stored in your database. So here's an example of some health service in the US.
Community health services.
That had 4.5 million patient records stolen by hackers. And the great thing about the US is there's mandatory breach notifications. So they have to tell their customers, they have to tell the industry at large, gets published on a website. Whereas in New Zealand, a lot of the stuff just gets swept under the carpet. So the Privacy Commission's trying to make it public here as well.
Yeah, we very much have the ostrich clause. So hide your head in the sand, sweep all security issues under the rug, and maybe they won't happen again.
Cool, sounds awesome.
So we are focusing, so when we're talking about advanced persistent threat, tiers 3 and 4. So this is, the key thing, it is advanced. Did you get that one? You see, Kirk actually did the little test before APT. He didn't actually score anything out of 3. So advanced was the first A. Latest attack vectors, zero-day exploits, which you talk a bit more around, and a high degree of covertness. So they're trying to not be found.
So they're persistent. So they're going at you over a long period of time, or once they're in your network, they're staying dormant for a while as they make their way through your network, trying to remain unseen, but remaining with a foothold in their organization. And some of the studies have shown that the attackers can be inside your network for 2 years or more before the company even notices.
And I guess the last bit, of course, they are trying to do something bad, stealing data, take it offline. So there is a bad element to it. So when I came up with a little persona before, so this is so we run a number of what we call shielding technologies for our customer base. So this is some stats taken out of New Zealand where we shield government networks and websites from attack. So can anyone... what prize are we going to give away for this one? Got a prize. We've got USB stick. We've got a couple of these. Who can guess what country is under the biggest blob? Who said that?
Okay. Excellent. All answers on the back of a tweet.
It's almost a USB Bluetooth.
Don't throw chopsticks into the audience.
To the absolutely non-Chinese looking fella. Here we go.
Well, someone could get hurt.
Oh, but that's fine. There we go. Okay. They are your prize. You
we
don't
did
just need to leave them there.
A few years ago in here, and we got a guy. No, we said whoever can chase Andy can win the copy of Visual Studio Ultimate.
Yes.
Some guy almost hurt himself. So we need to be careful now.
Yes.
But it was really funny.
We need to be careful.
Yeah, it was very funny.
So I love this one. This is Brad Smith, Microsoft EVP of Legal and Corporate last year, actually labeling the US government as an APT, which I thought was perfect. And again, that was when they were going through encrypting all the information at the back-end storage. And it's for these things. It is advanced. They were using zero-day attacks. It was persistent and never-ending, and the threat was they would steal data. So the US government is officially an APT, according to the Microsoft beast. So
but
it's not
it's
just...
It's great to see government organisations embracing industry standards.
Absolutely. I think that's great. So look, so the so just so that you know what we're trying to do in the day in our life, we are trying to do hacktivism. We are nation states. This is what we're paid to do on a daily basis. Go and hack other countries to steal their data, try and corrupt their economies. Illegal financial gain. So as an example, in the commercial side, so I was over in the US a couple of weeks ago. So over in the US currently, so live credit cards are currently going for $100 to $150 is what you'd buy a valid stolen credit card. Within 30 days, that drops down to $50, and within 90 days, that's down to $1. So that's kind of the attrition of stolen credit cards. Health data and privately available or privately privately identifiable information.
Personally,
that's the one.
That's okay.
That goes anywhere between 10 cents to $3, depending on how complete it is. And one of the biggest industries in that in America is actually the new the marketing research companies. So what they're actually finding is rather than go to a clipboard in the mall and ask you information about what you do, they just buy massive databases of it and then resell it to other companies as market research. So there's actually this huge growing industry in stolen information.
So other incentives they might have. So you might just be doing it for the fun. You might enjoy hacking stuff. And maybe you're young and carefree and the threat of going to jail doesn't worry you, or maybe you think you're covering your tracks. Or you could be a professional pen tester type person and you want to learn new techniques so that you can bring them to your day job. I'm sure no one from Aura does that. But, you know, there's been people put away who are actually pen testers.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. So you do have to be very careful of what you do and where you do it. So what is the APT landscape? So Kirk and his kids are massively into, they're kind of like Lego freaks, to be honest.
Imagine if there was a Lego person that big. That'd be scary, eh?
One of Kirk's giant Lego dude men. So, and what character is this?
This is the Emperor, right?
Okay, of course it's the Emperor from Star Wars. Yeah, no.
Episode 6. It's the Episode 6 version. Yep.
Uh-huh. Available with which set?
Can't remember.
Okay, moving on. So what is the, so what was the landscape? How did that look?
So sort of 10 years ago, things were simple for us in corporate security land. We had networks that we protected with well-defined borders. We had our DMZ, where we put our web servers and stuff. What am I supposed to do with that? Oh, animations. Right. We had our DMZ sitting there, where we put our web servers and our mail servers in. We had our network, where our staff worked in, and we were able to put a nice border around that and control the traffic flows really easily. And the main threats that the main ways that people could access our network were web traffic and email traffic, and not a lot else came in over the internet. I'm being a little bit loose with dates here, but yeah. 10 years ago, things were simpler. And then if we wanted to give staff access into our network, well, we had a nice place for them to jump through, which is our DMZ, and we could open up a VPN into that environment.
I don't want that.
You do.
No, I don't. All right, go on then. Okay, so so for us as an advanced persistent threatener, nice and easy. What we're trying to do, we're trying to maybe attack the users or get in from the internet facing. If we were lucky, we'd break into the DMZ via various areas. But the key thing we're after is just to get into the internal network. So that's it. Three steps of hacking. 1, 2, 3. From the outside, get in the DMZ, own the network, life's good, move on, go home.
And as defenders, it was pretty easy to defend here. You know, we could buy appliances that sit on the border between the internet and us, and things that inspect VPN traffic.
However,
so moving forward to today, the organisation landscape's a bit different. We've got users with mobile devices bringing their own devices into the workplace. I think that's a Windows phone. We've got people that are accessing cloud services, maybe platform as a service, infrastructure as a service. So our customers are accessing it.
These aren't Macs.
They're running Windows. We paid for our licenses.
Yeah.
Microsoft makes more money out of Mac users, I think, buying licenses. I just made that up. But
it's a good one, though.
It costs more for us than it does for a bundled... Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, so there's lots of cloud services. We still have some stuff sitting in our DMZ, like maybe a mail server or two, or a web server, but our staff are often connecting into these cloud services, sometimes over VPN or just normal connections. And our internal users are accessing these cloud services going out over the internet. So if you're kind of modeling these threats, you can see that data is flowing in a lot more places. The landscape's kind of changed for a lot of organizations, and traditional security's finding it hard to keep up with it.
So I guess at one level, right, we're still, as the threatener, trying to hop in, attack the user base in through the internet, still want to get into your DMZ, still want to get into your corporate data service. However, trying to break in through the cloud infrastructure is also just as juicy. This is where all the lovely application data, credit cards is going to be sitting. Now trying to own and get hold of the staff and the mobile machines. And of course, it's not just the lone advanced persistent threat as everywhere. There's a massive army, very, very coordinated. So there was a one of the recent sort of APT rings over in Latvia was shut down recently. One of the things they found were these IBM process manuals inside. So this actual group is actually following a nice IBM operational manual on how to do stuff very organized and very professional. So this isn't just a make it up as you go along. We are, as the APT is, highly bloody organized. And of course, if they'd used a Microsoft manual, it would have been far better. But they just happened to find the IBM one. Maybe because they weren't using the IBM one.
Cool. So let's actually go on to the day in the life of the emperor as he's trying to become a threat. So here he is using his Microsoft Surface version 1 because he hasn't bought the 3 yet for 10% off for delegates only. And he has a lot of angst because his plastic fingers don't work on the touchscreen. So what does he actually do in the average day at his computer? And I'm not saying that Surfaces are the tool for hackers, although that would be quite funny. So the first thing that attacker does is he comes up with a target. It might be a rebel base. More likely in our situations, it's probably going to be something like a company that we work for. And he's going to perform some steps. So I'll let Andy talk to these steps because he does them at work for a living.
So the recon phase is exactly that. Find out as much as you can about the target that you're after, both holistically, who works there, what they do, what have they got. Then you want to get in. When you're in, you want to stay in. You then want to escalate, so you've got in down here, but you want to get more access into the system. Then you want to spread out and move into other bits of the system, and from where you are next, start the recon all over again. So that's basically the process that we want to be going through as an advanced persistent threatener.
So they want to get deeper and deeper and deeper into your organization. So as we were saying, the first step is selecting a target. Well, that was pretty easy. We are all targets. The next step is reconnaissance. So trying to find out as much information as you can about a company, its employees. So it's pretty normal kind of reconnaissance techniques, you know, the who, what, where, when, how, why, when, what are they doing, that sort of thing. And there's lots of sources that you can go to find this information. So there's all the stuff that your staff members post publicly on LinkedIn, Facebook. Your corporate website probably lists key staff members, probably lists your physical locations and where your servers are hosted because customers want to know that sort of stuff. And it's pretty easy to find IP ranges that a company belongs to by looking at their web server and moving sideways and seeing what else is there.
Well, look, I know that marketing always wants you to give away free trials and demos, but we have in NZ found free trials and demos that contained encryption keys hard-coded into the trial demo. So it's kind of useful. So you can break the crypto on everyone else that's using it. Hard-coded usernames and passwords contained in demo systems. So all you actually have to do as the hacker is download the trial, reverse engineer it, actually see what it's up to, and it's kind of, you know, game on from there.
Yeah, so, I've found a lot of like QA system URLs and build server URLs and stuff like that, IP addresses. So one of the most efficient ways of doing this, of course, is to use Bing and to search for information on the internet.
Yeah, that's all we use.
Yeah.
Bing in our IE8.
Yeah, so you pay Andy $250 an hour and he uses Bing like a monkey.
Mm. I think everyone who uses Bing is...
Shut up. So there's a bunch of locations. We're trying to get invited back. There's a bunch of different things you can look for on the internet. They're all kind of obvious kind of things that we've talked about. Doxing is the hacking term for sort of opening the kimono on someone else. So basically releasing a bunch of documents about someone else's personal life. So I remember this happened to Andy. Someone went, I'm going to dox Andy Prow at Aura after Andy was in the newspaper. And it was really funny because they posted a document which said the name of his company, his phone number, and the name of his brother or something.
I know. And I was gutted.
Yeah, so...
It was destroying for a while.
That's a challenge to anyone here, so I probably shouldn't have brought that up. But he's got way darker secrets than his family's names, so...
Yeah. I know, dude, seriously.
And here's a picture from a TV show in the US showing awesome hacker tools. And this particular tool is called Fierce. So I'm just showing it as an example of what you can do. So you plug a domain name into the tool. It's a Perl script. It's pretty simple. And it just tries other common host names on the end of the domain name. So you know, like VPN customers suppliers dot something dot com, and basically comes back with a list of all the domains that resolve. And it turns out you can actually find a fair amount of information just by looking at other common domain names.
Quick one here. Anyone in here a really good UI developer? We got any? I'll tell you what, there is such a huge market in UI development for all the hacking tools. Seriously. What? Everything. Oh, I know. How about we make a green screen with like a really command
shell? This is a really cool TV program because it actually showed a real one rather than let's hack into the mainframe and like bounces going around. I just need to decompile the virus to, yeah. Here's another tool called Multigo.
Now it's starting to get a bit prettier. You see, this is one that, this is why this one's actually getting quite used in the hacker community because it looks pretty.
Yeah, so this is kind of a correlation and analysis tool. So you basically pump a lot of different information sources into it, such as IP addresses, domain names, email addresses, Whois lookups, etc. And then it helps you draw relationships between them.
It also goes hunting. So it hunts in things like, you know, your Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. So it will go information gathering. And the key thing as well is that it's not just the technical information, but it is also the people, the interrelationships between businesses. Customer recently, so we found out, so through a red teaming exercise, the best way in was through their subsidiaries, and that information was gained through, first of all, Companies House, and then moving down to the other businesses they owned. They were the weak ones that could get you in the door. So actually, this whole big picture is what you need to be doing to look at your threat exposure.
I keep getting distracted by this Twitter feed. I shouldn't have mentioned it. Keep tweeting to Kirk J, at Kirk J, if you want stuff to come up.
This is a good one.
And if your iPad password is 7712, someone's released that on the internet, so you should change it while we're talking. Cool. So the next phase of the APT's day is, it's kind of like a, you know, responsible disclosure or something. So the next phase for the hacker is actually getting into the environment. And you might think that I've been really dumb and displayed a real key of mine, and you'd now be able to make cut keys, but this is actually the letterbox that blew off and broke its key. So you can make it all you want, but Wellington weather has meant that it doesn't work anymore.
I do like the fact that you did see that as a risk, though. We've obviously sufficiently scared the crap out of you over time.
Yeah, don't take photos of keys. And also, if you get a custom credit card made by your bank, don't take a photo of it and put it on the internet. There's a whole Twitter stream of people that do that. It's quite funny.
I was going to say, this is another one of those great Kirk pieces of advice. That's good. No, that is
good. Don't take photos of things and put them on the internet. That's not what it's for.
Yeah. That's...
Yeah. Uh-huh. Cool. So the weakest link. So often attackers will just go after the easiest target, and sometimes that's not a technical target.
In fact, 99% of the time it's not a technical target. So without a doubt, the people in the organisation at... And I guess some of the time, I'm not quite sure where Kirk fits on this scale, some of the time it does go between the computer user and the ape. So
I reckon I'm the guy with the rake. No.
Are you the rake man?
I definitely don't stand as straight as the spear guy.
Yeah. I'm thinking more ape, but...
okay.
So...
I can live with that.
So when we're trying to attack, so what is the, so a lot of the most common ways into the user base, so the people inside the organization. So we've got, hopefully everyone's aware of phishing, very widespread net, blanket emails, and it's not really targeting an organization, it's just attacking anyone that wants to hit the link. So in APT land, it's more spear phishing. So phishing that has been targeted, or emails that have been targeted for to look as though somebody in your organization should pay attention, they should click it, and of course, whaling.
Sorry.
Really?
Oh, I was just thinking of the executives at my company and how they'd take to be called whales. But it does happen. Like companies that I know have had one executive email the other late at night and say, hey, I need to urgently transfer money to this vendor so we can buy a product. And so, you know, if they're not on the ball, it can happen. Yeah, you could fall for it pretty easily.
Absolutely. So this actually takes us to first demo. So this is a demo that took Kirk around about 3 months to put together.
Shut up.
So what are we seeing here, Kirk?
So first off, I had to build an online web-based email system. And that was 2 months, 30 days, 23 hours, and 30 minutes work. No, so I might be standing on the shoulders of giants. So this is an example of a real threat that we've used against members of our own companies. So this is the standard phishing email. So a realistic-looking LinkedIn message that comes in from LinkedIn notification that says someone who comes from a company maybe that I know but looks a little bit unfamiliar has sent me a
That's
message.
That's the key thing. Attractive.
I'm not going to comment on that. I'm married. And, you know, it's really, really easy for an attacker to make an email like this. So all they have to do is fake the from, and it turns out in email you can just put anything you want in that field, and all the regular email protections go on things like the server that it's sent from and the SPF record and things like that, all of which would pass if you sent a fake email. That went big. Here's this email, and then when you click on it to view the message, it takes me off to securelinkedin.com, which is a realistic-looking domain name.
And what was actually interesting, so we did run this one as... So we use this for an internal attack ourselves, so we like to try and attack and hack our own staff just to see how they respond. So we went and bought secure-linkedin.com from GoDaddy. We then went and updated the registrar information to be LinkedIn's own address, and it took 4 days for GoDaddy to actually email us and go, this looks like you're doing some phishing, to which we replied and said, yes, it's an active test to see who falls for it, to which they replied and went, all right. We were honest, you know, that's the key thing. We had a...
That's yeah. What you get when you buy discount domain names.
So it's pretty, it's, you know, it's hard to do.
So members of your company will go on here and type their password in. I mean, you've seen phishing sites all the time. And then at that point, their password's stolen. Quite possibly it's the same password they use on the corporate network. But, you know, nothing about this, nothing about the email nor the website they go to triggers any alarms in their head. It looks exactly like LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. The message is something that they're used to receiving. And the main protection you've got against this is to not use LinkedIn.
This is another great nugget.
Yeah,
today.
Which is my personal approach, possibly career limiting if you're looking for a new job.
So, what was I going to say? Oh, that's right. So, and of course, one of the issues with LinkedIn as well, they've closed it now. They did also have a sort of API you could actually go to redirect with a username and password that you had received and actually log the user in afterwards. So what would actually happen is from our site, we would then pass the credentials through. They would be logged in, and the only difference was that their LinkedIn screen wouldn't have Ashley Ferguson up there with a message. So if you'd fallen for it, you'd be like, oh, where did that go? But that was it. So the pass-through was seamless as well. So this is where you need to be careful about, you know, in your apps when you let people in through kind of backdoor logins. So that's cool. So we've gone for the user layer first.
I just need to make a point. Someone made a sarcastic comment on Twitter, which hurt me deeply, about me using Bing. And I'd just like to say that Bing is actually really good for reconnaissance because you can put an IP address in and it will tell you all the domain names that go to that IP address.
Somebody hacked Andy's jean zipper. Yeah. No, but you did just socially engineer me. I did just look on stage.
I already checked as well, actually, when that tweet came up. Cool.
So, success.
That was when I bent down and you heard a zipping noise.
Who did that? Oh, that is definitely worth not getting one of these.
No.
Yeah, no.
Cool. So,
look and weep.
So more ways that attackers get in to your company. Actually, we should take it out so they're not just looking at a box. So other ways that they can get into your company are through O-Days or Zero Days. And so we're going to talk a little bit about what Zero Days are and how people can break into your organization through them.
Who said Zero Days? Groovy. I'll take those who didn't put their hand up as either don't know or didn't put their hand
up. So this is a mathematical formula that determines zero dayishness impact. There's really kind of three factors into how ishness you are impacted by a zero day. Depends on how the security researcher finds security issues in the product, depends on how the vendor responds, and to some extent it also depends on how the customer reacts once it's been discovered. So we'll go through a couple of scenarios.
So let's start off. So when we talk about attacks and exploits and vulnerabilities, so exploits start life as vulnerabilities. An application is vulnerable to an attack. That's where life starts. Usually they're found through what we call fuzzing or testing, or maybe just by accident. So a researcher, someone in an organisation trips over, finds an application, dies, crashes when I send it certain data, that's actually now vulnerable to attack in some way. So that's where life starts. In the good world, they will responsibly disclose that to the vendor in question and say, hey, Mr. Vendor, you've got a security issue, to which the vendor takes on board responsibly. They write a patch. There's a hot fix. They do an upgrade to the system. Mitigation comes out on the website. By the way, turn off this service because it's currently broken.
And Microsoft's kind of the model example here for a responsible vendor.
Absolutely.
So they have a regular hot fix patch cycle every patch Tuesday.
Yep.
They take feedback from research as well. I don't know if you've emailed them. I have. You know, they have a whole process around making sure that they contact you daily, when they talk to you and that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely.
But a lot of companies I've contracted don't do that. And just as an aside, the thing that I contacted them about wasn't a security issue. It was a problem of my keyboard, apparently, and somewhere between that and my seat.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. We have had vendors reply to security notifications, and their response is, the system was never designed to be attacked in that way. Oh, of course. In that case, we apologise. Sorry. We'll just take down the security advisory, shall we? So what happens, though? So you have Patch Tuesday, and, you know, people often do take the mickey out of Microsoft in the security space. Bar none, they have by far the fastest patch release time, the most structured hotfix management process. But what happens after Patch Tuesday is then comes Reverse Engineering Wednesday. So every hacker and researcher out there on the planet looks at what's just been released. Everything, critical security patch, that's where you dive in first.
So you download the DLLs. You
absolutely.
Can, reverse engineer if it's .NET, compare the IL to the original IL of the pre-patch version and see what's actually changed.
Absolutely. So as soon as that patch is released, you're on a timeline now for the first exploits to be developed. So even if the researcher didn't tell the bad guys are absolutely reverse engineering the fixes straight away. What does it fix? When you know what it fixes, well, now I can start to write the exploit that takes advantage of it to get all those people who haven't yet patched.
And what Microsoft have done to sort of combat this threat of as soon as they release a patch, all the exploits come out straight away, is they have a vendor engagement program, which I think is called MAP, but I might be getting that confused, where all the antivirus and firewall and IDS vendors get advanced access to the hotfixes before they go out so that they can build signatures to detect them before the attackers.
So what's cool. Zero day? So the first step is that whoever found the security vulnerability did not responsibly disclose it. So perhaps it's part of your job. As a nation state somewhere in the world, that's what you're paid to do, find vulnerabilities, and you do not tell whoever it's for because you tell your boss because they're going to use it in some nefarious way. Or you're just a bad guy and you're going to sell it on the black market. So what happens first is that the exploits are the first things to be developed based on this vulnerability. Exploits released into the wild, these are zero days. When all of a sudden news is saying that there's a new zero-day attack, it's zero days because there are zero days to fix it. So it's now out in the wild. You click that website, your browser is owned. Now the responsible vendor is in that tight time frame to reverse engineer the exploit, see what the vulnerability is, now patch it, now release it, now you apply it. So the whole game's just been shifted on its head. And so this is classic zero day.
Yep. So even though as a customer you're applying your patch as fast as possible, that exploit was out on the black market, or maybe it was out in the NSA toolkit, for some time before, and so you could have been vulnerable in the time in between.
So there, of course, is the other zero days where, in fact, the researcher tried to tell the vendor in question that there was an issue. The response was, sorry, that's not actually a designed feature of ours, to which there is no patch. And so what invariably happens is that responsibleness tends to get boring and the researcher gets twitchy and it will get released.
Well, one school of thinking is that if the vendor's not being honest and fixing stuff, then you've got to let the customers know.
Absolutely.
Because if the vendor's not fixing it, customers need to know that that product's dodgy. But yeah, either way, it ends up with customers with unpatched devices or software in their environment, which then get exploited.
And I guess then there is the classic, and this is one of the most common ones that we see, which is it was responsible disclosure, there's been a hack patch available for ages, but no one bothered to apply it anyway. So that's not a zero day, that's just being silly and not applying security patches. And then, of course, you get the other option, which is where it wasn't responsibly disclosed. The vendor wouldn't have written a patch anyway, and it wouldn't really have mattered because you probably wouldn't have bothered installing it. So, and that's not really zero days. That's kind of, I guess, zero days of effort.
Yeah. So really what makes a VIN a zero day is when the security researcher does something bad, or if the vendor does something bad, that makes it a zero day. What we do as customers really doesn't make it a zero day or not. That's just regular bad sloppy practice that we do every day, not patching.
Every day. In fact, that's a good one. That's every day, not zero. Yeah. So who here?
We kind of diverted into what's a zero day for a while, didn't we?
Yeah. Who's going to say they rigorously apply all security patches as soon as they come out? Everyone.
Yeah. Except for this week, because they were at Techhead on Patch Tuesday.
Well, that's a good call. Bad timing. So for instance, so if we just have a look at, say, Stuxnet as an example. So everyone heard about the infamous Stuxnet virus, the Stuxnet worm. So it was targeting nuclear power plants, trying to turn them off. But one of the key things it did is it was using 4 zero-days in the Microsoft platform. So what did it do? So just out of interest, Stuxnet originally, the first way that it got in was it used an old vulnerability from 2008 that was originally used by Conflicker. So what it meant, Stuxnet wouldn't have actually gone anywhere if everything was patched against this original 2008 vulnerability. But that was its first foothold. That's where it was got through. And that was initially what it was targeting. What it then did is it had 4 brand new exploits. And this is in 2010, link exploit, so remote code execution. If the icon of a specifically crafted shortcut is displayed, that's a pretty low sort of bar for it to happen. A link's displayed on your screen. Poof. Printer spooler, so remote code execution if you got a specially crafted print request, keyboard layout settings, task manager. So these being zero days meant there was a time between when it came out, nothing was there to patch against it.
So just back on that one, the really interesting thing here from the security community was that this was a really targeted attack. Like, they were targeting Iranian nuclear processing facilities, I think. And yet, it spread out all over the internet, just on the off chance that someone in Iran would go to work with a USB stick and plug it in to the nuclear facility, and then it would shut down the SCADA systems that control the plant.
Correct. So basically, it was trying to target a computer that had one of the specific control boards in it, and when it got onto your computer, it would go, do you control a nuclear power plant? And your Windows machine would go, nope. Fair enough. Do you have any links? You've got a printer spooler? You've got something else I can do? Boof. Worm. It infects. And now off it goes to somewhere else to see if somewhere somebody must be running a nuclear power plant off the back of this machine.
And the other awesome thing about it was that each of these zero-day exploits that had been developed would be worth quite a lot of money on the black market. So if you come up with one and you sell it before Microsoft patches it, you can make a fair amount of money. And so this attack would have been very costly to pull off, especially from the private sector.
However, the rumours about who did it, apparently they had lots of money. So,
cool.
So if we look at as another sort of how these things roll, so if you look at the zero-day vulnerability that came out in IE earlier on this year, so what actually happened, 26th of April was when this memory corruption vulnerability was released. IE 6 to 11 were all vulnerable. The core exploit that went around was actually delivered through an exploit in a flash file. So as soon as you were running IE, looked at the flash file, it would own your browser. And that in-the-wild exploitation was actually targeting IE 9 to 11. And basically, just by you clicking on a website with this flash plugin, would own your browser. And it took, so there are 5 days until the patch came out. Of course, all browsers now have been patched.
But we don't want to pick on Internet Explorer because IE's actually got a pretty good, and IE's got a pretty good track record.
Yep.
So for our actual example, we're going to give the example of an attacker performing a zero-day attack. I guess it's not zero-day anymore, but what would have been zero-day attack back then against a Linux browser.
So what we're just going to do, we're just going to do 4 minutes for a exploit.
What did
of a
I say? Firefox? Did I say Linux browser?
Well, it's fine, but
Firefox, not Linux.
So what we've got here, so this is the Metasploit framework. So this is, if you look at how exploits live in the wild, so Metasploit, all you have to do to be able to hack things is buy a license from it, from Rapid7. So you don't have to be an advanced security researcher, you just kind of, it is very, very commercialized. So what we're going to do, if you haven't seen, so this is my Linux box, Kali, you can download this. This is running my Metasploit. Over here I have a Windows 7 box that's happened to be running Firefox. So over here, to set this up, so we're going to use an exploit, multi-browser Firefox. So this particular vulnerability in Firefox. If you sent it a particular request, Firefox would let you then send it an add-on that it would automatically add on to itself. So on a single request, Firefox would view a website, the request or the response from the website would basically add a custom add-on straight into Firefox. That's what it does. So to run this, you just...
So the cool thing about Metasploit is it bundles up a bunch of exploits, and then you can also write payloads for the exploits. So Andy's configuring a web server that he's going to host a web page on that's going to do something bad, and now he's going to pick a particular payload to run. And the payload he's picking, depending on how good his typing is just called a reverse shell. So when this payload runs, it'll connect back to his Linux box sitting out in nasty land and wait for commands.
So this is me. So currently that little thing, exactly, my Linux box is now a web server running this malicious payload, waiting for Firefoxes to come and browse it, and there are no active sessions at the moment. So what do we have to do? So in a drive-by attack of this sort...
So all the user has to do is follow a link, right? And people do that all the time, especially if they're following phishing links or emails from people that look like their colleagues, or they just happen to be browsing around the web. And it could be any page on the internet that causes a drive-by attack.
So did you see that? Did you see how long it took? So there was like, if you watched closely, there was a little box that went poof, and that was Firefox installing a new add-in. And the new add-in it just installed was the remote shell add-in that had just been given from the website it browsed. So that little box, poof, that was Firefox getting owned. So here I might wrap the rest of my page in, you know, normal Facebook kind of content, whatever I might want to do. But this is now an owned Firefox browser. That's all I had to do was browse it. So if we now have a look at the sessions that we have, oh, look, we have someone connected in. So this remote shell, what does that actually mean? So if I go to my sessions here and say, hey, dude, can you just run DIR for me? DIR gets sent across the wire, runs in memory under the Firefox process, and returns back the directory listing of, so we're currently running on my hacker machine, the C program files Mozilla Firefox.
So now the attacker's got code running on that Firefox browser as the user that's using the browser. So it's running as Kirk on that computer, and it can do anything that Kirk can do. Although I think here your VM's got a user called IE user. But yeah, so it's just running as a user on that VM. So as long as Firefox is running, I can keep sending commands, or Andy can keep sending commands, to run any arbitrary code that the user can run. Like, for example, the calculator. So if you're ever browsing the internet and the calculator pops up...
I know. Doomed.
Yeah, because you don't want people using your computer to calculate.
So
now the attacker's next step, of course, is to make sure that they can stay on the computer.
Because, of course, what happens right now... Poof! As soon as I close Firefox, then, oh, my exploit's gone. So as soon as the hacker's in and owns your browser, whether it's owning IE, so those things you saw in Stuxnet, remote code execution, that's exactly what someone could do by you viewing a website with that exploit. That's it, game over. This was Firefox, but as soon as you shut the browser, it's gone. So this is where persistence kicks in straight away. As soon as I'm in as the attacker, next thing I want to do is persist it. So how can I stay there?
Cool.
Poof.
Ah, there's persistence. Excellent. So there's different ways that an attacker could persist on a network. My clicker stopped, so you're going to have to advance.
Ooh. That's
there
good.
You go. So there's several different ways that you could stay into a network. So the first thing you want to do is to disable any defenses on the computer that you've attacked. So maybe turn off its AV if the user's able to do that. If the user's a local admin, then you're pretty lucky, and a lot of companies let users be local admins on their own computer, then you can create user accounts or create change configs, set stuff to run at startup. The code can download rootkits and other software. And antivirus will detect some of those things happening on your computer until you disable it. But there's this kind of polymorphic, is that the word? There's ways to transform your code so that it's not detectable by antivirus by basically just repacking it in different ways.
And in fact, there's a number of sites that you can buy as a service. So you get your new virus, new bit of malware, you upload it, and what it will do is it will spawn that off to all of the major antiviruses just to see if you can get detected. And if you do get detected, it tells you which ones. You'll modify your code a bit more, send it through until you get a clean bill of health that says no one actually recognized you as something bad. Great, sound AMI. Bit of malware is free to ship. So that's a great, again, it's kind of malware diversion as a service.
Yeah, so the attackers got into the computer. Now they want to control it remotely. So there's a few different ways they do that. I want to stay there.
Oh, sorry.
And the most common one is an outbound command and control channel. So they've got out on the internet some compromised boxes or whatever that they're using as their command and control, where they want to instruct these infected machines what to do. And normally that won't be at their house unless they're a particularly dumb hacker. It'll be some other machine they've compromised. So there's a few levels of indirection. And they'll send traffic from the user's computer in your environment out there asking, hey, what should I do next? And that's where the command and control channel comes in. So it's normally outbound because most firewalls don't let incoming traffic go through to individual desktops. If they do, you've probably got bigger issues. But these days they're using a lot of really standard kind of protocols for their communication. So HTTP, HTTPS, things that your users do on a day-to-day basis. If it's HTTPS, you probably don't even have the ability to look inside that traffic at your border and see what's inside it anyway.
So the step one. So first of all, we wanted to persist. So we've got in. We had a look at you. We got in. We've persisted in some way, the fact that we've remained in. What was the next thing we wanted to do again?
Thank you.
Escalate privileges.
Escalate privileges. So I said they might just be a regular user account, in which case they probably want to become a local machine account. Once they're a local machine account, they probably want to get something else on the network. So a really obvious target is Active Directory, becoming a domain admin, because in a lot of Windows networks, once you're domain admin, you're God, and you can do anything you want. And so there's a bunch of different things you'll do to try and elevate your privileges and make it so that you can transfer through the network. So some example things that can happen on the actual machine itself. Windows is progressively becoming more and more hard for attackers to do this. If they've got control of a machine, it's getting harder and harder. But what you've been historically able to do is access the SAM database or look in memory for passwords that are floating around of other users on the machine.
Or talk about that passwords.txt in my documents.
yeah. And look around. Also, if there's any backup sitting in there, maybe there's some juicy stuff inside them. Applications that are running on the box, perhaps with higher privileges that you can attack through. Unpatched operating system. And once you're on a machine, then it's a really good time to coerce someone else in the organization to log into that machine. So say you've got an attack where you can sniff the hash of a password as someone logs into a machine, then your attack might be to email the support desk and say, my computer's going really slow, can you log in and check it out for me? And as soon as that domain admin logs into your machine, then you've got the hash of their password.
And particularly, I guess
kind of just spoiled three talks by saying that, but yeah.
But they're not our talks, that's fine. So the so that's the privileged escalation. I guess the other bit we want to do is now move around. So how do we spread out and look for more juicy stuff? So we've just owned Kirk's machine, but he doesn't really do much.
That's true.
So from that perspective, how do we now broaden out and access other stuff around us?
So this is kind of what I was alluding to. So there's this pass the hash attack, which is getting a bit of PR at the moment because Microsoft's put a whole bunch of new mitigations into the operating system to help prevent against it. And there's actually two talks that we'll refer to, one in the next time slot and one on Friday, that go into the depths of pass the hash, and it's quite a fun topic. I kind of have a skewed version of what fun is. But the way the pass the hash attack works is basically you capture the login credentials on one machine, move sideways onto other machines in the network, and from there move to servers or more high-value targets. And then from there, you aim for the Active Directory controller or domain controller.
And I guess at this point, the key thing is that you haven't stolen the username and password at any point.
Yeah, that's right. In the past, the hash attack, you're not actually stealing the user's password. You're just stealing the hash that Windows networking protocols use to prove you are the person you say you are, which I guess is the same thing as stealing a password. But. Cool. Okay, hiding under the cover of noise.
So one of the key things that you want to do as an advanced persistent threatener is not be noticed. You want to be covert. You want to be there for a long period of time. So this is where we actually see a huge proliferation of DDoS attacks. And so often DDoS attacks are purely for bad things. So whether it's taking down the PlayStation network or a lot of the gaming networks or whether it's taken down government websites. So DDoS itself is used, whether or not it's viewing images or whether or not there's a DNS reflection attack going on in your network. Who knows? There's various news stories along that line.
Bit of miscommunication to the media over the weekend about telecoms issues.
Absolutely. So the point is, though, that the DDoS itself is destructive, but it's actually what it often covers that's the real damage. So during these DDoS attacks, it's used to amplify the background noise and the background radiation to keep you running around like a headless chicken, while actually that's when the attacks are happening.
So often the DDoS attacks, just to back that up, are coordinated with some other attack that's going on in your organisation. So they're trying to move covertly through your network, but something they do is going to be noisy. Maybe they're going to try and brute force a password. So if the systems administrators are busy at that time, dealing with the fact that the internet is down, and then they can do that.
So this is this DNS reflection, this is actually what's been running over telecoms networks, or this is one of the suggested stories of what's been running over the networks.
I think Telecom confirmed it today.
They did on
their Facebook page.
Correct.
Weirdly.
So that's the key place to get the information from. So with DDoS DNS reflections, so DNS servers are out there looking up, giving you IP address to domain name resolution. Now, as an attacker, in the olden days, we used to use, say, if we've got a web server we're trying to get to, we would try and flood that web server with traffic. However, what we've found is that it's infinitely more effective to go to vulnerable DNS servers on the internet that are open to DNS reflection, which basically says, hey, DNS server, Kirk really wants to know a bunch of information. And the DNS servers go, Kirk, here's what you want to know, buddy. And what actually happens is that your web app's fine, but all your network routers at this point, and that last mile, that last pipe of information, has now been flooded.
So the interesting thing there is that it's an amplification attack. So one attacker couldn't probably bring down your router, unless they were a telecom user on fiber, apparently, viewing porn. One attacker couldn't send enough traffic to bring you down, but they can send small amounts of traffic to all these DNS servers on the internet, and the DNS servers will amplify that into a large response. So anytime you see a small request with a large response, that's kind of like a warning sign. Last point going to be there? And the other thing that's nice about DNS, and indeed about NTP, which is on the next slide, is that they're UDP-based protocols, which means that it's not like TCP. You can fake your sender address, and the reply will just go to someone else.
So NTP amplification, so NTP, the network timing protocol that's used. So there's lots of servers out there on the internet that say, hey, I will give you some time. So there's lots of time synchronizing so that things work properly. So here's an NTP reflection that we'll just run through as an example, right? So it takes 30 characters. So 30 characters is the request. Monlist, it's actually just a command that NTP servers are starting to not respond to, but most of them have been responding for a while. And it's just kind of an admin. It just says, hey, look, can you send me your monitor data? In other words, can you just tell me everyone that's actually been requesting a timestamp from you? So if you think of a busy NTP server on the internet, then it actually lists you everyone that's been trying to ask it for timing. So this example that we just run through, as an example, the response for 30 characters is 47,500 characters. So there's a 1,500 times or more information sent back, which means even a small botnet can actually trigger a huge amount, because NTP, like DNS, is made for very fast responses. So an NTP server and a DNS server, they're made for people to keep going, hey, what's this web address? Hey, what's the time? And they respond very, very fast. So you don't just do this once. You keep doing it. So this is what, like, for instance, so Derp, back in February, he created at the time on his tweet, it's not every day you launch the world's largest DDoS attack. Of course, he's not very good with apostrophe. It should be worlds with an apostrophe in there. Thank you very much. So 400 gig was the attack that came in. So with a lot of our customers are kind of like, oh, hey, what's your international bandwidth pipe? Oh, it's 5 meg. Cool. So on the whole, a 400 gig attack is actually pretty damaging. Swathes of the internet die when this kind of traffic is flowing around. We had one that hit so what we call Red Shield. It's what we use to shield a lot of our customers. So back in March, we had a similar one off 2,500 servers, and it was actually a government sector organization was the target. So these NTP servers, 2,500 NTP servers around the world, had been told that this government agency was desperate to know the debug data of the NTP servers. And so they all responded really quickly. So how does this reflective damage work, right? So I've got this great hacker terminal, because it's green screen with a plain text. So I'm just going to send this is my request. I'm just going to send a monolith request to the server sitting somewhere else in the world, poof, and it replies instantly. So the reply that just came back to me in an instant from the server out there on the internet is...
Yeah, you know the scroll bars they invented?
Stuff.
Them,
it's... okay, well, there's a crap mode of it, right?
Microsoft invented scroll bars.
Yeah, there we go. So that's what one request does. So basically what I do, I create a botnet that just keeps sending this request. So the actual attack on Kirk, it just looks like this. That what he's actually getting is 400 gig of plain text from NTP servers or around the world, all going, hey, dude, this is what's going on, this is what's going on. Is basically the technical description for an NTP reflection attack.
Poop noises. Cool.
They work.
Okay, so in the last 4 minutes, so how do you keep these attacks at bay? Well, that's a little bit hard to answer in 4 minutes, but I guess what you can see is that these are advanced threats. So these people are persistent, they're coming after your company, and it's very hard to defend against that kind of motivated attacker. You can't just put a glass on them and wait till they die. That picture's kind of disturbing now that I look at it. I don't know what I was thinking.
He's trying to touch the screen. Open. So one of the things that we do find when we're looking at the what's hitting the shields coming in is it is constant. There is a constant barrage of stuff trying to get through to our customers, port scans, attacks. What's interesting, sometimes we do some research, so we'll let something through the shield, but we won't let the response out. So we'll set up a demo environment for the customer. Let's let an attack through. Let's see what it would have done to your system, but let's not let the data out just in case it's bad. And what you'll notice is that when that happens, there will be an immediate spike that something, say a SQL injection, we get blocking all the SQL injection on a website. Now that's fine. We'll just let it through. So now we'll let the SQL injection run through, hit a website. Now what happens is that there will be a massive spike. So in this scenario, in minutes, 40,000 new SQL injection attacks come through. So the probes that are out there are kind of going, is it vulnerable? Is it vulnerable? And it goes, yes, it is. And now we'll actually hunt in on the thing that's just been exposed. So the automated nature of these is quite rapid. So what do we recommend? Staying watertight. And I like to use that phrase of watertight, that your systems out there, whether it's your websites, whatever systems you're running in the cloud, you're now out at sea. And so going to sea and to the deep ocean in a 99% waterproof boat is still pretty bad. You're going to sink at some point. So you're after 100% watertight is what you're after. So the first thing that we always find you must do against these advanced persistent threateners, make sure you're doing some good risk assessment work. So threat modeling, business risk assessment, understand what systems will live where, how are you going to manage when these systems are under attack, when a DDoS floods in, when it gets owned, what can I do from there? And that's the first bit you need to be looking at. Multiple lines of defense, so all the devices and all the locations, all the users on all of the apps, what is the one thing you're doing? Is there another line of defense? If this gets owned, how are you going to manage in its time of ownage? All the devices, so we see a lot of this with bring your own device. So bring your own doesn't necessarily mean manage your own. And so a lot of the time, the BYOD devices aren't managed properly. They're not locked down properly. If they're lost, well, I don't have to tell you because I'll just go and buy another phone because it was my phone. So you don't know that that phone with the AD credentials is now sitting on a bus. So it's not a security incident. It just happened. It just went away. What I did like, there was a fellow who gave a talk earlier on this morning. It was on Office 365 on an Android device, and it was quite nice. Office 365's got a web admin interface to wipe device, which one would think would remove Office 365 and all the data. It actually doesn't. It factory resets the device. That's kind of awesome. So I can't remember the guy who gave the talk, but that's kind of cool. Not kind of really what you want to happen from, please remove this application. So incident response. So this is where one of the best... defenses that we find is this kind of what we call red teaming and fire drills. So when you're coming under attack, what is it you do to respond? Who's the comms team? Who's the management team? If you get owned on the inside of the network, on the outside, who is it who's actually going to manage the incident? And this is where visibility and visibility are the three key items that you want to be looking at. So even some of the information, say, that's coming out of, if you look at the telecom attacks over the weekend, or the Spark, shouldn't call them telecom anymore, it's the wrong name, dude.
Yeah, they're on fire.
Anyway, over the weekend was the key thing that they couldn't see where all this was coming from. There wasn't the right monitoring to go, where's all this traffic coming from? They had to do a lot of work to identify what was running on the network before they could then look at... oh, hi, Mokina. Are you trying to...
That's not me.
Yeah.
You've got Bluetooth turned on while you're doing a hacking talk on stage.
Makes it a bit fun. I like to live on the wild side.
You really have become a manager.
That's...
That's the worst insult I can think of.
Exactly. Sorry, dude. Demotion time for you. That's right. CEO time. So look, I guess what we're going to do, so So we're running a threat modelling here tomorrow, 11:55 to 12:55. There is lots more pass the hash goodiness. Chris and Alan are doing talks both today at 3:10. Check, and there's one going on tomorrow. So find out from those boys more about half pass the hash. I think we'll do one of those. Great, awesome. Now, so prize time. So we have we started 3 minutes late. We've got 40 seconds to do prizes.
Okay, hang on. So the first prize goes to Glenn Cross.
Glenn Cross.
Come up at the end if you're too shy to come
now.
No,
come up now. See, he already stood up.
Okay.
He was keen.
Cool. Second prize of another Bluetooth speaker goes to Alan Birchall.
So we did a good tweet?
The Burby prize for the person sitting next to him as they have to change their PIN number. And the third prize goes to Farhan Sata, which is another USB device. And then the booby prize, well, it's not actually a booby prize.
Does that mean he wants the virus-ridden USB stick?
No, I think that we're going to give him a Bluetooth
thing. Okay,
cool. And then the booby prize is for Mamu H, who asked if they can win your hat, and I decided that they should get a USB stick, and then they can wear that on their head.
Oh, no, he can win the hat. Admittedly, it's kind of like all like worn and... It's a bit manky.
Okay, they can get both then.
Oh, groovy.
So you four come up at the end?
Excellent. And that was us. Thank you very much. Cool.